Good morning. My name is Howard, if you missed that. I'm on the leadership team here at Hebron Church. My surname is Newton, like the hymn writer, John Newton. I have not written a hymn to summarize today's sermon. Next time. To quote three very famous people, Alan McKinnon on the video just said, "If the Lord is God, follow him," talking about Jesus. Val Graham, also talking about Jesus, said, "What people thought of me was not important. What people thought of Jesus was hugely important." Stephen, when he praying to Jesus, "Thank you for how you introduced yourself to Val." All those three quotes are relevant to where we're heading. We're now well into a series on John's Gospel, and today we have arrived at chapter 5. You had it right. And like much of John's Gospel, chapter 5 seems to ask two questions. Firstly, who is Jesus? And secondly, what is our response to Jesus? With respect to the first question, Jesus does some extraordinary things. And then he says some extraordinary things. With respect to the second question, several folk in the chapter respond to Jesus. Their response is not very encouraging. All of the passage will appear on the wall, but feel free to follow through in your own Bible. John chapter 5. Sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for one of the Jewish festivals. Now, there is in Jerusalem, near the Sheep Gate, a pool, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by five covered colonnades. Here, a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed. One who was there had been an invalid for 38 years. One small question. One medium-sized issue. The question first, why did a great number of disabled people lie there? One possible answer is that the pool in question was by one of the main routes into Jerusalem, just before you got to the temple. With that in mind, it may well have been the prime spot in the whole of Israel if you were forced to beg for a living. What about the medium-sized issue? If you look behind me, or I have an NIV Bible, you will notice that there is no verse 4. Why is that? Well, the oldest Greek manuscripts that we have at present are not in agreement. Some contain an extra couple of sentences. Some do not. The NIV includes these sentences in a footnote rather than in the main text. Let's have a look at them. Some manuscripts include here, wholly or in part. Here a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed. And they waited for the moving of the waters. From time to time, an angel of the Lord would come down and stir up the waters. The first one into the pool after each such disturbance would be cured of whatever disease they had. One big question comes to my mind when I read this. Is this what the people thought was the case? Or was this actually the case? On the one hand, this really doesn't feel consistent with the character of God, that he would have a race for disabled people, where the winner gets cured. But on the other hand, it feels dangerous to make that into an absolute statement. Verses like, my ways are not your ways, my thoughts are not your thoughts. They always caution us. It's a dangerous business when we start telling God what he is allowed to do, when we choose to box him up. But having said that, this extraordinary phenomena of healings at the pool is mentioned nowhere else in the whole of the Bible. To me, it feels it is probably some form of superstition which had crept into Israel. So what happens next? This feels slightly inevitable. The Lord himself comes to the pool. He cures one person, and he causes a great disturbance. One who had been an invalid for 38 years, but one who was there had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, "Do you want to get well?" Jesus asks a simple, direct question. The most obvious answer is, "Yes, I do want to get well." Another understandable answer would be, "I have been an invalid for 38 years. I'm not sure how I would cope if I was made well." He wouldn't want to make a judgment at this point, but the man's actual answer feels slightly evasive. When Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, "Do you want to get well?" "Sir," the invalid replied, "I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I'm trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me." "Do you want to get well?" The answer is not yes. It is not no. It feels a little bit evasive. It feels a little bit defensive. It feels almost as if what he heard Jesus say was, "So, you've been an invalid for 38 years. Do you want to get well?" And his reply feels a bit like, "Don't blame me. It's not my fault." It's hard to understand. At this point, Jesus could engage with the whole "first man in the pool gets cured" question. He could say, "You are right. It's unfortunate that you never get to the pool in time." Or he could say, "That whole pool thing, it's just a piece of superstition, I'm afraid." Jesus, sadly, doesn't do either thing. He doesn't engage with the issue at all. What does he say? "Then Jesus said to him, 'Get up, pick up your mat, and walk.' At once, the man was cured. He picked up his mat and walked." Sometimes it's a problem. It's a problem that we are so familiar with the Bible. This is extraordinary. Who is Jesus? He is someone who can say to a man who's been an invalid for 38 years, "Get up, pick up your mat and walk." And when he says this, the man's body physically changes. He is no longer an invalid. A quick aside on the business of trying to box God in: Jesus heals many people. There is no obvious pattern to how or why he heals certain individuals and not others. Sometimes he heals with a word, sometimes he touches the person, once he spits in mud and puts it in a man's eyes, once a lady is healed just by touching his gown. Usually it's individuals, but once it was 10 lepers at the same time. To one person he says, "Your faith has healed you." But on this occasion, he heals a man who never asks to be healed, never shows any sign of faith, any sign of appreciation, or any sign of respect for the man who has healed him. The only thing all these miracles have in common is the person of Jesus. Who is he? The day on which this took place was a Sabbath. Sabbath is a special name for Saturday in the Jewish week. Oh, I think I've gone on too far, haven't I? No? Anybody sense a problem there? No? We'll press on. The day on which this took place was a Sabbath. Sabbath is a special name for Saturday in the Jewish week. So what? What difference does it make what day it was? To answer that, we need to go back in time to about 1,500 years before Jesus. God has just saved Israel from slavery in Egypt, and he's in the process of explaining to the Israelites who he is and what he is hoping for in his relationship with them. Part of that surrounds a one-day holiday he wants them to take each week. Exodus chapter 31. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Say to the Israelites, you must observe my Sabbaths. This will be a sign between me and you for the generations to come, so you may know that I am the Lord who makes you holy. Observe the Sabbath because it is holy to you. Anyone who desecrates it is to be put to death. Those who do any work on that day must be cut off from their people. For 6 days, work is to be done, but the seventh day is a day of Sabbath rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day is to be put to death. The Israelites are to observe the Sabbath, celebrating it for the generations to come as a lasting covenant. It will be a sign between me and the Israelites forever. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed." Observing the Sabbath was not a small thing for Jews, and even today it is still not a small thing for practicing Jews. Immediately, the Jews had a question. What constitutes work? What exactly are they allowed to do on the Sabbath? What is okay? What is not okay? In chapter 35, we have an account of Moses taking what God has said to him and passing it on to the Israelites. Moses assembled the whole Israelite community and said to them, "These are the things the Lord has commanded you to do. For 6 days, work is to be done. But the seventh day shall be your holy day, a day of Sabbath rest to the Lord. Whoever does any work on it is to be put to death. Do not light a fire in any of your dwellings on the Sabbath day." That is the first piece of detail as to what it actually means to not work on the Sabbath. Do not light a fire in any of your dwellings. By the time of Jesus, an extraordinary amount of detail has been added to exactly what not working meant. Let's return to the pool. The day on which this took place was a Sabbath. And so the Jewish leaders said to the man who had been healed, "It is the Sabbath. The law forbids you to carry your mat." It's not an unreasonable objection, given where they were coming from. My favorite response to this would have been, "I'm really sorry. I do respect the Sabbath. But you have no idea what just happened. For 38 years, I have been an invalid. Today, I was miraculously healed. I will leave my mat here and collect it later. I have got to find the man who just healed me. Is that what he said? But he replied, "The man who made me well said to me, 'Pick up your mat and walk.' Don't blame me. It's not my fault." How did the Jewish leaders respond to the man? My favorite response would be, "You have been an invalid for 38 years. You were healed today. That's incredible. Look, is it okay if we just check the facts? Because if this is true, man alive." Is this what they said? Did they ask him about his healing? So they asked him, "Who is this fellow who told you to pick it up and walk?" It's not that the small picture doesn't matter, but if we are ever so obsessed with the small picture that we become blind to the big picture, there may be a problem. The man who was healed had no idea who it was, for Jesus had slipped away into the crowd that was there. The man had no knowledge of Jesus before that day. If it feels like I have been judging him a bit harshly up to now, it's because I've been judging him a bit harshly up to now. We have the benefit of knowing the end of the story. Without that, I would have been inclined to give him the benefit of the doubt at several points. Later, Jesus found him at the temple and said to him, "See, you are well again. Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you." These are chilling words. See, you are well again. You have been physically healed. Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you. Spiritually, you are still very sick. The consequences, if you don't get this sorted, are serious. How would you respond if you heard a firm and scary warning from the Son of God? How did the man respond? The man went away and told the Jewish leaders that it was Jesus who had made him well, not to give him the glory. The healing of the man at the pool. On many levels, this is a disturbing account. The man is hard to understand. But let's forget the man for a moment. Who is Jesus? He is someone who, with a word of his mouth, can transform the body of a man who has been an invalid for 38 years. He is someone who, when he meets that man, knows what he has been doing, knows what he has been saying. He is someone who is able to look inside the heart of a man, and all is laid bare before him. So who is he? Jesus now starts to address that question himself. Next slide. So, because Jesus was doing these things on the Sabbath, the Jewish leaders began to persecute him. In his defense, Jesus said to them, "My Father is always at his work to this very day." There are echoes of the passage in Exodus here. Jesus says that God is always at work. He doesn't take Saturdays off in the same way he asked his people to. That sounds fair enough. But what point is Jesus about to make? My Father is always at his work to this very day, and I too am working. What applies to God applies to me. And more than that, God is my Father. Did the Jewish leaders understand what he was saying? Yes, they did. For this reason, they tried all the more to kill him. Not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. The Jewish leaders fully understood what Jesus was saying to them. They just seemed not to believe him. Jesus goes on. Jesus gave them this answer: "Very truly, I tell you, the Son can do nothing by himself. He can do only what he sees his Father doing. Because whatever the Father does, the Son also does." Jesus says there is complete parity between what God does and what I do. Whatever the Father does, the Son also does. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all he does. Yes, and he will show him even greater works than these, so that you will be amazed. For just as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, even so the Son gives life to whom he is pleased to give it. What is Jesus saying? Quite a lot, I think, but the simple part is this: God is the source of life. I am the source of life. Moreover, the Father judges no one, but has entrusted all judgment to the Son. The Old Testament makes it clear that it is God who judges people. He is the only person who has the right, who has the authority. Jesus says, all judgment has been entrusted to me. Who is Jesus? What is the distinction between him and God? A man cannot have two masters. To what extent should we honor God? To what extent should we honor Jesus? Moreover, the Father judges no one, but has entrusted all judgments to the Son. That all may honor the Son, just as they honor the Father. Whoever does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who sent him. Question one, who is Jesus? Question two, what should our response be to Jesus? Moving on. Very truly, I tell you, whoever hears my word and believes him who sent me has eternal life and will not be judged, but has crossed over from death to life. We're born, we live, we die, and after death, we are all due to be judged by Jesus Christ, our Creator. This is not good news, because we are not good. But there is good news. Very truly I tell you, whoever hears my word and believes him who sent me has eternal life and will not be judged, but has crossed over from death to life. Very truly, I tell you, a time is coming and has now come when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. For as the Father has life in himself, so he has granted the Son also to have life in himself, and he has given him authority to judge because he is the Son of Man. Do not be amazed at this, for a time is coming when all who are in their graves will hear his voice and come out. Those who have done what is good will rise to live, and those who have done what is evil will rise to be condemned. By myself I can do nothing. I judge only as I hear. And my judgment is just, for I seek not to please myself, but him who sent me. Extraordinary things to say. The discussion now moves on. Jesus is saying the most extraordinary things about himself. Why should the Jewish leaders believe him? From here on, the language, it feels like the language of the courtroom. If I testify about myself, my testimony is not true. This issue is dealt with in much more depth in chapter 8. So I will leave that to the lucky person who has chapter 8. Jesus seems to be referring to the problems associated with appearing as a witness on your own behalf. There is another who testifies in my favor, and I know that his testimony about me is true. He is referring to his father. You have sent to John the Baptist, and he has testified to the truth. Not that I accept human testimony, but I mention it that you may be saved. John was a lamp that burned and gave light, and you chose for a time to enjoy his light. As I said, Jesus is referring to John the Baptist. It is very hard for us to appreciate how important John was during Jesus' life on earth. The people were in no doubt at all that John was a prophet sent by God, that his word was completely trustworthy, largely, I think, because of the way he died, as well as the way he lived. John backed up Jesus' extraordinary claims about himself. Jesus also points towards the limitations of human testimony. I have testimony weightier than that of John, for the works that the Father has given me to finish, the very works that I am doing, testify that the Father has sent me. Look at what I do, Jesus is saying. How is it that I can heal a man who has been an invalid for 38 years? How is it that I can stop a storm with a word from my mouth? How is it that I can raise the dead? And the Father who sent me has himself testified concerning me. This may refer to what God himself said when Jesus was baptized from heaven. It may refer to everything God had said about Jesus in the Old Testament, which is where Jesus is heading next. You have never heard his voice, nor seen his form, nor does his word dwell in you, for you do not believe the one he sent. You study the scriptures diligently, because you think that in them you have eternal life. These are the very scriptures that testify about me, yet you refuse to come to me to have life. The whole of the Old Testament is about Jesus testifying to who he is, what he has done, and what he will do. Why believe the extraordinary claims that Jesus makes about himself? Well, for the Jewish leaders in particular, these were very powerful reasons. He may be a distant figure to us, but they knew who John the Baptist was. They knew the complete and utter reality of Jesus' miracles. They never denied that Jesus was doing the most unbelievable things. They loved the Old Testament. They love the detail. Do not carry your mat on a Sabbath. They loved the scriptures that taught continually about the man who now stood before their very eyes. Who is Jesus? What was their response to Jesus? Yet you refuse to come to me to have life. The Jewish leaders are every bit as hard to understand as the man at the pool. I do not accept glory from human beings, but I know you. I know that you do not have the love of God in your hearts. I have come in my Father's name, and you do not accept me. But if someone else comes in his own name, you will accept him. How can you believe, since you accept glory from one another, but do not seek the glory that comes from the only God? But do not think I will accuse you before the Father. Your accuser is Moses, on whom your hopes are set. If you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me. But since you do not believe what he wrote, how are you going to believe what I say? In this chapter, several folk have a personal encounter with Jesus Christ. In closing, two thoughts and two questions. First thought, it is our desire that the people we know and meet, that they would have a personal encounter with Jesus Christ. It is possible for someone to have an extraordinary personal encounter with Jesus Christ and yet never to come to know him. Very sad. Two questions. Number one, who is Jesus? Number two, what is my response to Jesus? Maybe today is the first time you have been asked these questions. Maybe they are questions that you answered many years ago. Either way, it may be good for us to consider them once more today. I will borrow from Steve, if that's okay. We'll spend a couple of minutes reflecting on these questions, and Debbie will lead us, and Steve will pray.